Hello, and welcome to Geek Speak on KDNK. My name is Steve Skinner. I'm here with Louie, the computer guy.
Hey, Steve.
And Matt McBrayer from the Roaring Fork Help Desk.
Hello, everyone.
Joining us, we have a very special guest in studio, David Aguilar. He's the past director of science information and public outreach at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a naturalist, astronomer, author, and space artist. He's also a musician, plays with the band, the Chocolate Watch Band. David, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
We're taking your phone calls at 963-2976, 970-963-2976. David, I got up really early on Saturday morning and I saw the space station go by.
Isn't it kind of fun to see that thing haul across the sky?
17,500 miles an hour, I'm told.
Yeah, well, they don't hang their hands or their heads out the window as it goes over, but it's really fun to watch.
Yeah, and I guess the space station's been going and occupied for 15 straight years now. Pretty exciting, and it's pretty fun to see.
Wow, it's a strange environment to be caught up in. It's nothing like planet Earth.
Yeah, I do prefer it down here on Earth, but I've seen some pictures from the space station, and it's pretty incredible view that they have of this big blue ball that we're on right now.
Yeah, they come back, and they're changed forever once they've seen it from up there. A very different perspective.
Tell our listeners right now what we're seeing in the night sky in Colorado. What are you excited about seeing out there now?
Oh, I've been watching Mars and Saturn. They're both over in Scorpio in the south. And Mars is just pulling away from the Earth. Mars gets close every 2 years. It takes a two-year orbit. So we've seen it's gone bright red. We've been watching it very closely in case the Martians launched an attack. But apparently, they figure Trump's running. That'll do enough damage on Earth. So let's just keep it rolling. Save a few bucks.
And how can you tell that you're seeing Mars? And what time of night do you get to see it? Or you have to stay up way later?
No. The moon's going to be right in the middle of it right now. But go out when it's dark, look to the south, and you see this big red star-like object directly in the south. That's Mars. And to the right is Saturn. And below it is Arcturus, the heart of Scorpio the Scorpion.
And how can you tell that, Arcturus is the closest star, is that right?
No. Proxima Centauri is closest. It's about 1,700 light years away.
Oh, okay. It's closer than I thought.
it's a truck. It takes a while to get there.
What's the fastest speed there is?
Speed of light. It's the rule of the universe. 186,000 miles per second.
And is light the only thing that could possibly travel that fast?
Well, we think so, but you never know.
Talking to David Aguilar, and he is an astronomer, among other things. Tell us a little bit about what else we're seeing in the night sky. What do you see through your telescope that we can't see with our naked eye?
Right now, directly overhead is the Northern Cross, Cygnus the Swan. Beautiful constellation. Just trace it out. It does look like a big cross in the center of the sky. And right at the tip of it, the bottom of the cross, it's a beautiful star. It's a double star system. And there are a lot of planets out there that have two suns in their sky instead of one like ours. And those two, one is blue and the other one is the most gorgeous golden color. So imagine if we had a blue sun in our sky and a gold sun also. It'd be kind of cool.
That would. Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I've been reading up on the negative effects of blue light.
Louis, enlighten me.
And we would no, go and on. None of us would be sleeping. So,
well, if the orb that we're on is rotating, then we would get darkness on the other side.
Wow, depending on your orbital path.
Made me think there for a minute.
So they just discovered a planet with is it the Kepler telescope?
Yes, Kepler Space Telescope.
Kepler Space Telescope
is a class M planet, right?
And they're calling it Kepler like 186F or something. Exciting name.
Yeah.
But tell us about what do you know about Kepler? Planet.
Oh, the planet. Well, there's about 3,800 of them right now. Which one do you want to talk about?
Well, the one that's in the
class
habitable
M
zone.
Planet.
The habitable zone.
Class M. Oh, this be a weird world. It's very close to its star, and it needs to be because M stars are about a quarter the size of our sun. They're bright red. They live forever. And so you got to get closer to stay warm. So this planet's really close. It orbits, I think, in about every 17 days, 20 mm-hmm. days, somewhere in there. There's a lot of those that we've found. But you could possibly live on this planet. It would just be a very weird world, nothing like Earth. The you would encounter whatsoever. It'd be very odd and strange.
Well, you're one of the people that actually takes your imagination. You take what you know with science, and then you take it to the next step. I've seen some of your books where you've done renderings and models of potential creatures that are out there. So what kind of creature would you, if you were going to, you know, maybe make a book about this habitable planet, potentially habitable planet, what kind of creatures would you imagine would be there based on what you know so far?
There'd be three different types of creatures because this world is unlike Earth. Earth spins on its axis, gives us night and day. This world spins, but it's so close to its star, it's locked. So one face of the planet is always facing the star, and one side of it is always facing into outer space. There's no sunrises on this planet. So there's no sunset. So the side facing the sun.
I was getting excited till I heard that.
No.
This is like just a big Hawaiian tropic commercial.
It is. You know, it is. But here's the cool part. The part facing the star is hot. It's really warm. So if there's oceans there, they're constantly evaporating, turning into clouds, and they're heading towards the north side where it's cold, the backside. Backside's freezing, probably has glaciers on it. Mm-hmm. But there's never a sunrise or a sunset, but just like a monk's haircut, there's going to be this ring that goes around the planet where it's always twilight, and that's where you're going to find the cool creatures, because they'll venture into the hot side, they'll venture into the cold side, they'll probably see infrared into the dark, they'll be able to see infrared at night, create night vision. So this would be a really weird world for humans, but a really nice place for strange, bizarre creatures to live.
Talking to David Aguilar, he is the closest thing we have to a rocket scientist here in the Roaring Fork Valley. David, that's very exciting. How certain are you that there's life out there? I mean, it's got to be, right? It's just a humongous universe.
The numbers are too big, and there will be life, but most of us and a lot of NASA people agree it's going to be slime, sludge, and bacteria. We're not going to find a lot of shopping malls on other planets or aliens zipping around in UFOs. It's probably sparser than we think, but there's life, but not quite what we're hoping for.
Now, if there were, let's say there are shopping malls, did everybody start around the same time?
No, that's another kind of cool thing. There's two groups of thought that we're about 4.5 billion years old, our planet, so, and it's taken all that time for us to appear. But there may have been some that started a little up before us. And just think of what 100 years difference in technology right now would make. 1,000 years. And so they could be dramatically ahead of us. But then there's another whole group that says, hey, guess what? We're the first. That's why nobody calls us. Nobody tweets. Nobody leaves a message. We may be some of the first life in the universe. Plenty more to follow. But we were the ones out of the chute first.
And well, we've started the Petri dish here. Maybe we should blast a few of those molecules towards the other planets just to make sure something continues.
Well, we've done that already. We've really? Probably contaminated part of Mars. We've certainly sent stuff to the moon and beyond. So, yeah, we are sending viruses and bacteria and other cool stuff out into space on our spacecraft.
What excites you about astronomy and writing books? And your books aren't exactly kids' books, but kids could definitely relate to them because kids are really into dinosaurs and outer space, I've noticed.
Yeah, well, I'm a kid, and I've never grown up in that sense that I still have a beautiful wonderment for this planet, the life on it, everything that's around us, and it's all connected. That's the beautiful part. You just have to look and see that. And so I enjoy that, and I enjoy finding those combinations and connections.
And what about your books? Describe your books to our listeners.
Well, they are kids' books. They start out as kids' books, although I've written some older books also. But it's payback time for me. You know, I've had a wonderful career. I've done some fantastic things in life and some wonderful experiences. But I'm still a kid inside. And I think how books influenced me and changed my life. I still have some of the books I had when I was a kid. And I want to give it back. It's time for payback.
Mm-hmm. Your books are fun. Where can people find those?
You can see them on Amazon. You can pick them up in any bookstore. And hey, this Friday, can I do a plug?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. I'm doing a special presentation at the Basalt Library at 5:30. I'm going to talk about two of my books, and there'll be some books there I'll sign, and people can pick them up there.
Are you going to be showing artwork and things like that?
Yeah.
What do you do at one of those book signings?
Yeah, I'll show how I create the aliens and the creatures. It's much like Hollywood. I make them out of clay and plastic and all sorts of weird things, and then they turn into my artwork and turn into life, and I'll show them that, and I'll just talk a little bit about the books. Alien Worlds is one I'll talk about, which we were mentioning. Then I'm going to talk about cosmic catastrophes, 7 ways to destroy a planet like Earth. And these are for kids who like things that explode and go bang in the night.
That reminds me of Matt McBrayer.
Type 1A supernova, yes.
Yeah, 1As are nice. That's how we figure out the distances and time through space.
When have you traveled to some of these gigantic telescopes that we have here terrestrially? And what's the biggest scope you've looked through and what have you seen?
Fortunately for my job, that's what I did for a living. So I'd be off to Hawaii and looking through the large telescopes of Mauna Kea. I've been to Chile. The largest I think I've ever looked through visually is about a 100-inch telescope out in Massachusetts, an old observatory. And the beautiful part about that is when you look at it with your eye, it starts looking like Hubble pictures. But then I had to climb a 50-foot ladder and look down on top. So that's the largest. Most telescopes today, we don't look through. We just put a camera up and take images and take a look at the images on our TV screen.
I've looked at your telescope, and it's big, and we didn't even look at the full magnification because there's a little breeze out there and stuff. You know, I saw the rings of Saturn through your telescope, and the whole thing's kind of quivering. So just having something to weigh these things down and make sure that they're holding still must be an art in itself.
Well, it is, but it's an instrument, and you learn to drive it just like you learn to ride a bicycle or ski downhill with your skis. But the beauty of it is, it's another dimension. This is outer space. We're just a drop in outer space. We're just this tiny little dot. And yet, there it is. It's there for us to look at and share every night. And I cruise through it using a telescope instead of a spaceship. But I would certainly, if a UFO landed right now, I'd get everything together and say adios. Gotta go.
I'm so glad we got into the subject of telescopes because I need some tech support with my telescope.
What do you need? What's going on with it?
Well, I've got like a Celestron Omni XLT, and I should know the exact, but it's about this big around. So that's how big.
Wow, that's huge, Lou.
How big the reflector is on it. And so, you know, when I first got it, it came with this kind of basic lens set, you know, that I could like really examine the craters on the moon. You know, really, really well.
Sure.
But from everything I understood, you know, I had all the basic lenses that came with it when I first got it. But when I started trying to, you know, it comes with all these star charts and I'm like, okay, I'm going to find Saturn. You know, everybody wants to see the rings on Saturn.
Yeah.
So I'm like looking, you know, figuring out exactly where that is and everything. Well, you know, then it couldn't find them, couldn't find Saturn. And, you know, I looked of course on the internet and, you know, basically learned that with the lens set that I had, it wasn't going to happen. You know, I could see Saturn as a speck in the sky, with the basic lens that came with it. But, I entered in the value of this lens and everybody said, well, you're going to have a really good time inspecting the surface of the moon with that lens, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went out and got myself a beefier lens and then a Barlow.
Yeah,
which is, you know, basically a 2-to-1 multiplier for those of you who don't know what a Barlow is. And so now I'm getting into some pretty interesting stuff, but the problem that I'm experiencing is I have a non-motorized mount.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm trying to make the pitch to my, you know, to the person who like approves all purchases in our house that I need a motorized mount, you know, and she's just not going for it.
Wow.
She's like, it's like, This telescope, you just keep needing more things for it. It's like, and she's kind of pulling this, you know, only a crappy carpenter blames his tools, you know. So anyway, if you could expound on me, you know, because the problem is when I find these really exotic targets, I'm just constantly having to adjust because of the movement of the Earth. And so is that pretty much?
Well, you know, there's two camps on that. Yet it's nice to have, it's called a clock drive in it. It counteracts mm-hmm. the rotation of the Earth. And so the object you're looking at just hangs right in the eyepiece. Those are really nice to use, and I have to use one for the big telescope.
Mm-hmm.
But half of my life has been observing using this carbon-based power source called my left hand that pulls the telescope as I look through it. And I just got used to it.
All right.
But I'll tell you what, Louis, some night, haul that sucker out, bring it over, let's take a look at it, and let's put it through its paces and see if we can get it going.
Okay.
Now, Louis, I know that you've looked at the sun a few times through this thing. How's that going for you?
I look at it every day, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Even when I was looking through David's, the moon is so bright, it almost hurts your eye.
Well, it is. It's really big. And I have, believe it or not, I had a slightly smaller telescope than that one. I set it on fire one afternoon. We were at a barbecue and everybody was laughing. And I lifted a beer and somebody said, "Hey, is your telescope on fire?" Because the sun had come right down the tube. And it focused just like a magnifying glass.
Sure.
And there it was.
It lit your beer on fire?
No.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
No, I drank it fast enough. But the telescope was sitting there on fire, which was really kind of a bummer.
Talking to David Aguilar, local astronomer and author and science guy, for sure. And if you'd like to talk, you can give us a call at 963-2976, 970-963-2976. How did you end up building your observatory in Missouri Heights? How does that location, is that just the ideal spot for this valley in this area?
It used to be. And I have to say, I'm going to be honest with you. We picked up the land over 10 years ago. I'm from Boulder side and did a little stint in Cambridge and came back home. But we looked for dark skies, and dark skies are critical because over 80% of the United States people living in the U.S. cannot see the sky any longer because of all the street lights, all the lights on at night, all of this stuff. We are losing contact with our universe. So that's why I moved here. But Willett seems to have taken it on its own to take care of that for me. Whatever that is down there. Is that a city? Is Willett's a city?
No, it's an annex of basalt.
Did aliens drop it out of the sky one night?
No.
It's bright. They've got light shining.
They keep dropping
everywhere.
New buildings. Have you noticed that?
And they just keep lighting it up like daytime.
You go away for 2 weeks and there's a new shop.
There's
a new
one
building. It's like, it's just like the other one, you know? So anyway.
One, the newer lights are a bigger problem because they have a wider frequency, wider spectrum. The older, the orange ones that you used to see on the one have a fairly singular wavelength, and you can filter that out.
Yeah, the sodium vapor, those were very easy, the peachy color, but now they're using LEDs. And
so
they're
bright.
Using mercury vapors and there is a plus, though, because since in the last 10 years, all these lights and developments that have gone on, that it has literally stopped crime on Pluto. All that light just shining into outer space. It's stopped crime.
What about Uranus?
What about, here we go?
Oh, sorry. You must get those all the time.
You know,
especially when you get
just
people
had to go there. I didn't even get 15 minutes after the hour.
No, I was waiting for this. You know, I do lectures for third and fourth graders. I think I've heard almost every Uranus or Uranus joke out there. But Whitmonami, come on, throw one out there.
It's okay. It's okay. I just wanted to, I was just wondering if you'd seen it.
Well, time and history will never forget the first man on Uranus.
Tell me
what's
more.
What's that one? What did toilet paper and the Starship Enterprise have in common?
I don't know.
They both circle Uranus and
fight search
Klingons.
Of Klingons. Yes.
Oh,
that's so wrong, Louis.
Open a window, Louis.
So, what's the best way for people to start dipping into the sky? What's a good entry level way to start enjoying what you're seeing up there? Do you just start studying the constellations? Do you study the solar system? What do you think?
Constellations are easy because they're the road markers. It's like learning the states of the United States. And if you get just above anywhere in the hills up here and it gets a little bit dark, even with a pair of binoculars, you're going to see a lot of fun stuff in the constellations. But learn a few. You don't have to learn 1,000, although there's 88. Learn about 10, and you'll wow and amaze your friends.
Hey, let's take this phone call.
Sure.
Hi, you're on with David Aguilar.
Oh, this guy is great. I'm loving you, David.
Thank you.
You're talking about the sky and all that stuff. But I wanted to clue back into the sky and say, what is the closest galaxy to our planet? And can you see it from the northern hemisphere, or do you have to go to the southern hemisphere? A note on the side, if people are looking for some sort of guidance on the planet that comes in a very simplistic form and also along with some good advice about time, space, continuums in an old form. The Farmer's Almanac's got a lot of dirt going on in there. But anyway, looking forward to hearing your answer. And thanks for being on the show. You sound great.
Sure. Thanks. I'm having fun being here. Closest galaxy to us is the Magellanic Clouds, and you do have to go to the southern hemisphere to see them. Actually, there is a closer galaxy, in the northern hemisphere, but it's in the opposite side of Sagittarius, which is the center of the Milky Way. And evidently, our Milky Way is a cannibal. It's eating a little galaxy right now. We can pick it up with radio telescopes, but we can't see it. But if you want to see two more naked eye galaxies, you have to go south. You can see them from Florida. I've seen them from Texas. But when you get down into Australia and down below, they're magnificent in the sky.
Talk to us about dark matter.
Dark matter. It's a weird material. It's something.
It's real?
It's real, and it's a material, and we don't know what it is. And what we realized is galaxies are like beautiful merry-go-rounds. All the stars in them spin. It takes us about 250,000 years, I think, to make it one rotation. But so these big merry-go-rounds are spinning around through space, but something is holding them together. Everybody should be flying off like somebody really jacked up the speed on a merry-go-round and you can't stay on the horses any longer. But we aren't.
Hmm.
So that's what dark matter is. It's holding like big arms around the Milky Way galaxy, everything together.
And the big question is, what's the matter?
Nice.
Right?
Yeah, he delivered that so smoothly. He's been waiting. He wrote that last night. I know he did.
I've been so waiting for that. What do you think about TV shows and science fiction and stuff like that? I mean, I was always so excited to watch the early Star Trek episodes because I just felt like they invented everything we have now.
Well,
except for transporter beams.
Well, that's true. But, you know, they're working on that right now. We've started breaking things down to a molecular level, and we're trying to see if we can transport them. I like them because they talked about what if. You know, I was never a big fan of fantasy because fantasy never happened, never will. But science fiction just might happen. And so I was a little bit more into that.
You know, Captain Kirk, what if there was a blue woman? Maybe you would be attracted. Who knows?
You know.
He was attracted.
And yeah, I don't know if you read the book or saw the movie, but I read the book and then I saw the movie for The Martian. And I thought the book was just,
I love The Martian.
Just so delicious. And then, of course, the movie was good, but didn't touch the sequence of events like the book did. What do you think of The Martian?
I love The Martian because it's an homage to one of my giants, one of my gods, a gentleman named Chesley Bonestell, who in the 1950s painted all of those beautiful paintings about the exploration of Mars, spaceships in orbit around the Earth, and he was using Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley, the best experts at the time, to put it all together. And that movie is an homage to him, and it even opens up, if you look into the NASA headquarters where they're talking, and behind the NASA director, there's a painting of Chesley Bonestell's on the wall. So when you saw that beautiful Mars panorama that just spread everywhere, I saw that from a 1950s book that he first painted. So that's why I loved it.
And, you know, I've always enjoyed the old school comedians like Nicholson May, who did a skit on the Van Brons at home.
Oh, yeah.
And how they were first working on Thor and Vanguard.
Well, you know, Wernher von Braun's an interesting story. We brought him over from Germany after the war, and a lot of people in the U.S. government did not want to work with him because he was a Nazi. He was supporting them at the time. So there was a lot of conflict.
What's the next solar event that you're excited about that we get to see?
2017. There's a solar eclipse. I think it's in August, I'm pretty sure.
The 21st.
21st.
We're going to be in Nebraska to observe it.
He comes all the way across the United States.
Are you going to get on top of one of those big ladders?
No,
he's going to be in
a crop
circle. He's going to do a crop circle and
get out
observe
of town.
From there.
No, you can. You don't need a telescope. You don't need anything. And I've only seen one solar eclipse. I saw it in Australia, and it was quite dramatic. It was amazing because imagine in the middle of the day, you're watching this chunk disappear from the sun, and it's growing smaller and smaller. And then suddenly it gets dark, and the stars come out, and the birds wake up going, "What in the world has just happened?" The world's turned upside down for 3 to 5 minutes, and then the sun comes back.
The Neanderthals must have freaked out when they saw stuff like that. David Aguilar, thank you so much for joining us on Geek Speak today.
Sure.
Really appreciate it. I'm Steve Skinner here with Louie, the computer guy.
Thank you, Steve.
Matt McBrayer from the Roaring Fork Help Desk.
Have a great evening.
And the one and only David Aguilar from Planet Earth.
Mostly.